Naples was early development. Naples was world where I was born.
Yeah.
I think it was clear back to pre-1900.
Yeah, so I thought it's
Del Mar
Show. Yeah.
Del Mar Show was much later. But I, although I was in Long Beach when the filming of Del Mar Show was done, I was too young to remember it. I don't remember anything about it. But I can remember Del Mar Show when there were just scattered houses. And, of course, I remember Anaheim Landing. When I was a kid, I used to go fishing down there with a neighbor. This is site now at the Seal Beach Naval Ammunition Station over there. And in that area, of course, it's been very expensive with all the people. The protection of tidelands or wetlands is something which has only happened very, very recently in California. And, we haven't done much job on it because, as I say, we only began to pay attention to it just a very few years ago. Incidentally, the Long Beach case gets a good deal more attention than other places in the state. But the total acreage of land which has been so used in the San Francisco Bay Area is probably 1,000 times as great as it is in the Long Beach area. I mean, it's a massive situation in the San Francisco Bay Area. And it's still going on. They're still filling the bay up there. In ways that we're just not sure what the long-term effects are going to be. I mean, it could be quite damaging to the ecology today. But that was just within the month, driving along San Francisco Bay and south of San Francisco, and I see extensive filling and still going on. They're filling right now. But much of this was done, just privately. Somebody would throw up a little dike and build a few shanties on plowing, and pretty soon the shoreline is owned by somebody. What was the public shoreline is gone, and now it's private shoreline. This happened in about 1965.
Okay, we're talking about why downtown markets decline. What do you think about the theory that it was Harry Russell's fault that he didn't want competition with his department store?
This is part of it, although I would suspect that a more important thing would be that many of the larger landowners in the downtown area had always waited for the city to bail them out. They were always waiting for somebody else to do it. And then, of course, when the development of cities came along with the great device of tax increment financing, that they were always waiting for this kind of a deal that would allow the property owners to get great appreciation in the value of their property without having to put out much money themselves. In other words, socialism for the rich, the kind of socialism we mostly have in the United States. But part of it was also due to the fact that there were a lot of rather small owners in terms of the extent of the downtown acreage that they had. He didn't live in Long Beach, and it was the old absentee landlord kind of thing. And what could, of course, be the most important factor is the development of the shopping center and the discount store which made the kind of merchandising that had been done in the life of downtown Long Beach obsolete. So there are a lot of factors involved. Other factors, of course, relate to individual decisions of companies, whether it be Sears Roebuck and Press Telegram and Puff and so forth. But I think that the fact that central cities all over the country were deteriorating would indicate that Long Beach was probably just part of the pattern that was happening nationwide.
But somebody could decide or do something about it more quickly than
Long Beach. Oh, yes. If you look around Santa Monica, for instance, there's a beach community, and the county did not suffer the kind of decline. But San Diego, the downtown area of San Diego, went through a period of tremendous deterioration. And why some cities did and some cities don't, I have never analyzed. But I'm sure that in the case of Long Beach, an important factor was the fact that they were looking for a bailout from some public agency, and they weren't interested in putting their own money into it. One example of that was the fate of the old Wise Building, which is now a bank building downtown. At one time, this was owned by Buffum's, Press Telegram, and I don't know who the third other major party was, and they bought this building for a song. It had been empty for years. And they came up with a bright idea that would make a fine building for a public library in Long Beach. And of course, this was a two-pronged operation. First of all, a new public library on Pine Avenue would help to revitalize Pine Avenue, and these people owned property on Pine Avenue. And secondly, they hoped to triple their money by selling this thing to the city, because they had bought it at fire sale prices and they wanted to sell it at much closer to what they thought would be the proper value of the property. This never came off, and eventually the building was rehabbed and turned into a bank. But it was kind of an odious example of how the downtown property owners were trying to manipulate the city for their own advantage, while all the time waving the flag and proclaiming their patriotism. And this was part of the problem. One retailer I knew on Pine Avenue very well, a fellow by the name of Ira Forrest, whose family had Francis Children's Shop, which was a very successful business on Pine Avenue, a specialty store, children's clothing and furniture and toys and so forth. Ira's family got involved in the discount business. As a matter of fact, he was married to Galvin and Joyce Levin. His family owned the Gem Jewelry and Loan Company on Pine Avenue. And they were involved in the formation of the discount house known as Gemco. Gem right off the Pine Avenue hot shop. But at any rate, Ira inherited the family clothing business, which was the last thing in the world he wanted. He was a geologist, was not interested in running a clothing store, even though his mother and father had done so very successfully for years. But he inherited business at the time when Pine Avenue was in decline, and actually what he inherited was a bunch of debt. So in order to salvage something out of it, he got into the business of selling or opening children's departments in discount childhood in various places in the LA area. And early on in the adventure, I talked to him, and he said, merchandising Pine Avenue style is totally impossible anymore. He said, I can sell the identical merchandise that I sell on Pine Avenue. I can sell it for 20% less in a discount house and make more money. He says it's just a more efficient method of merchandising, and the whole specialty store type of business of the Pine Avenue is just an anachronism. It's never coming back. And this was his opinion based on experience both places, and I suspect that much of the fate of downtown Long Beach is related to that. Now, we're going to have an experiment with this new mall, which is in the process of construction now in Long Beach. The funny thing is that this mall is really going to be a fixed-up old downtown Long Beach, and it will be mostly specialty houses because they will not be the big department stores as anchors, but they have in most large city malls. And I have rather dim prospects for the mall in downtown Long Beach. I think it's going to turn out to be an operation which is just going to struggle along, and it is never going to revitalize downtown Long Beach at all. Well, the other things that are planned, the convention center and the hotel improvements and so forth, actually they're going to make a lot more difference than the arena. The people who keep a boat in the arena don't necessarily spend their money in the people nearby. And there isn't any reason to believe that the marina will cause any revitalization, any considerable revitalization of business in downtown Long Beach. The convention center business, if they can ever get it off the ground, could make a difference, a significant difference, especially if they build a half a dozen good-sized hotels and really make the convention town out of Long Beach. The only difficulty is that everybody is after the convention money, and can Long Beach compete with Los Angeles, San Diego, and Anaheim in this area? I think it is somewhat questionable, and it is a gamble, but once again, much of the money that is involved in this gamble is public money, and so the people who are playing with it, you know, they're not running too scared, because it will be the citizens of Long Beach and the state of California that are the losers if this convention ploy does not come off.
Are you expecting
to get that? No. The people who brought us to Queen Mary are practically all out of the council and city government. I'm trying to recall if any of them are still aboard. Tom Clark might have been there then, but he would be about the only one. But Russell Ridley would be.
But he's also the people in the harbor.
People in the harbor did not bring us to Queen Mary. It was probably pretty council people who go between Mary and a few. I don't know who else. Local promoters. It was just a half-baked idea. I never thought through, and it was sort of thing that just happened. I mean, here was the Queen Mary on sale for junk at $2.5 million or whatever it was. And Councilman Bob Crow and a few others got the bright idea that this would be a fun activity, and so they were able to con the State Lands Commission into the use of guideland oil monies for this operation on the basis that they had a marine-related public serving activity, namely a marine museum, which they were going to develop on this. So public funds were used in very large amounts, probably $60-70 million on this Queen Mary fiasco, really under false pretenses. I mean, it was a con the whole way through. State lands people knew it, state legislation knew it, city officials of Long Beach knew it. But nobody ever blew the whistle, and now we find ourselves over our head with this thing, and it's a monstrosity and embarrassment, and a classic example of a very, very poor business decision being made by public officials who didn't have anything themselves to lose. You know, they're very casual about it. So. Well, if it works, it'll be fun, sort of an attitude. If it doesn't work, heck, it's only Thailand all money. But I don't think they're the same people that are that are running the show today. To me, it's pretty good.
And Thailand
all money
is still on
Asian, but what do you mean by Thailand? Oh, yes. The biggest the strength of Thailand all mine. It's not as damn the development of the Long Beach Harbor. And this has been a constructive and it's been of value, of course, to people all over the region. I mean, not just the city of Long Beach. But you can justify the certainly the expenditure of the harbor. It's more difficult to justify the arena, the convention center, the theaters, and so forth, being built with state money, and the government or money is really state money, of which Long Beach is a trustee. The 99% of the citizens of Long Beach somehow have the idea that these are Long Beach city monies. They are not. But and they resent the fact that the state has anything to say at all about them. But if they did their homework a little better, they realize that these are state monies, and as Long Beach is privileged to be the trustee of these monies, that they are supposed to be used for the benefit of all the people of California, not just the city of Long Beach, and not just the local backpackers.
But
then,
is the arena
I don't know what the financial situation of the arena is. They bulk in the current financial listing. If they put it together with the convention center, I think that most of the studies I've seen, and this, of course, is probably due to the fact that the marina may well pay for itself and may well make a little money, but the rest of the convention center complex is a big loser. And by putting them together, they put the best face on it they can. Well, part of that problem is due to the fact that the original Thailand grant restricted the Long Beach operation very, very severely. Something like the development of commerce, navigation, and fisheries. I think was the original jurisdiction they had. So what they had to do was to rationalize anything under one of those rubrics, and that's got to be a little difficult. Of course, the Mallon oil fields, which flat off ship Long Beach with about 50% of their Thailand take, plus 135 million or so in the bank at one swoop, was brought after the city council proposed the use of Tri-Glen Hall money for the completion of the Veterans Stadium out by City College. That was a long way from the guidelines, extremely difficult to justify as any furtherance of the arts of navigation, fisheries, or commerce on the sea. And of course, the city was just desperate to spend the Tideland money, and they had that $135 million sitting in the bank and burn a hole in their pocket, and they were determined to spend it. But you see, they are limited to spending it on or adjacent to the Tideland. Later, court decisions broadened that to include recreation, so that they could spend the money for beach development, protection, improvements on the beaches, and so forth. The Long Beach Marina was built under the commerce definition of the title and responsibility.
The
Alameda State Marina, yes.
I think the
second
place there
is
the title,
but there's going to be another one. There will be a downtown marina, yes. But the Alameda Bay Marina was built under the rationalization that this improved seagoing commerce, which of course is phony. But the whole administration of the guideline trust that got through was phoniness and twisting of definitions.
In other words,
convenience and affordable for the big Marina company, that money became available to build the Alameda Marina at the time that they were beginning to develop their land adjacent to that facility. Yes, except that it's not quite that simple. The push from the marina was much broader than any Dixie push. I don't think Dixie was primarily concerned with furthering that or the success of that. The big push from the marina came from the yacht owners, who were a local, well-off group, pressure group, who have been very effective all over in getting docking facilities built for their convenience. And of course, in the early days of the Long Beach Marina, since this thing was built with Tideland oil money, the slip rates were just rock bottom pure cheap. Because, you know, it sort of felt that the marina was free, Tideland oil money, that's free. Therefore, slip rates should reflect the maintenance cost of the operational cost in the marina. And in the early days, that's about what they did. Of course, it's a new ballgame now. With hard times and post-crop 13 times in the marina, it is now thought to be, one of the better money makers one of the few money makers in the Tidelands agency, with the reorganization of the city government, the marine department is under the Tidelands agency. Slip rates were being constantly raised to keep them in line with the commercial marina rates, so there are no more big bargains for fat cat boat owners in the public marina.
That really was more of a coincidence.
Oh, yeah.
The marina was developed there at the same time
that
the land on the east side
was being
subdivided and opened up to
the real estate. Well, part of the reason, one of the main reasons why much of the Dixie land was slow in developing was that much of the Dixie land was laid out under oil leases. And the treaty release is such that these people have the fifth use of the land during the life of the oil lease. And so that the presence of those various oil extraction facilities just tied up the land. And then, of course, what's happened since is that with the tremendous increase in the price of crude oil, and oil from these rejuvenated fields is essentially OPEC price. You know, it's very expensive oil. They get a lot of money for that over the oil. It isn't old oil, excuse me. You know, in the modern definitions, it's under a pricing definition which allows them to charge the high price for the oil. It now pays to go in and do secondary and tertiary recovery. And the last time I talked to the city petroleum engineer about those properties, I asked him, I said, how long can you expect these things to be producing? He said, nobody knows. He said, they can well be for 40, another 40 years. The tertiary recovery method, we just simply don't know. Because the art is being developed for the extraction of that hard-to-get portion of the oil that sticks to the reservoir material.
When is the first time you saw snow?
First time I saw snow?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We used to go to the mountains, slide on the snow. Oh, shoot. And I didn't know we were on. Didn't pay attention. And I can't recall the occasion, but I must have been quite young, you know. 5 or 6 maybe. Could have been younger even. But it would have been in the... Well, we usually went to Big Pine, which I guess is in the San Gabriel Mountains.
And did you go often?
Or? No. Maybe once or twice at the most a winter season. But it wasn't often, no. We never had proper snow gear. I think we had one old wooden sled we had. And at one stage we got a toboggan. I never owned a pair of skis, for instance. But mostly we'd borrow a little snow equipment, and it was just a local mountain. I never lived in the snow country until I was in the Army in World War II in Illinois, and then I was in southern Italy during that. Maybe it's snows of the century, I guess, and when we were over there, we had 2 feet of snow in southern Italy.
Anyway, I was just kind of sitting there curious about, because people who grew up in Long Beach sometimes you can see the mountains from the wind blows, and you can see the snow up there sometimes, but often it's not
so
early in one's life that
one
actually feels that it's cold and wet.
Well, I had that brought home to me when I was doing student teaching at a junior high school in Los Angeles. One winter day, we had one of those absolutely crystal clear days after a big rain and heavy snow in the mountains. And looking to the north from central Los Angeles, it just looked like there was a white wall up there to the north. And I remarked about it to the students, and they hadn't even noticed. This was an inner city school in downtown Los Angeles. And so I took the class out on the school grounds, and we looked at the mountains. And the kids gasped in surprise, because there were many of those eighth graders who did not know those mountains were there. you know, they indicated this. I mean, they must have seen them at times, but somehow or other it never came through. But when they, on that crystal clear day with a tremendous amount of snow on the hills, they just looked like you could almost reach out and touch them. And the thought that that big mountain, that peak was right next door, was just shattering to them. They just couldn't believe it, even when they saw it. But a lot of these kids had never been to the mountain. Out of that same school, I took a field trip to Point Furman to the Cabrillo Marine Museum. And I had quite a few eighth graders there who had never been to the ocean, who lived in Los Angeles. And they had never been to the ocean. But that's the shattering to me. You know, how could these people be so isolated in the ghetto that they actually, from where they lived to the Santa Monica Bay, can't have been more than 12 miles, and yet these kids have never been to the ocean.
Yes,
well,
it's completely more shocking than figuring out the snow. One of the other things that I was thinking about that we didn't talk about is how well your education at UNC, especially in your education as a teacher, prepares you once you're faced with actual classes full of children.
Well, the education department at SC was such a bunch of phony BS that I never had any illusions that many of the education courses had anything to do with the real-life classroom situation. So I didn't go out with the idea that I was all prepared to do a great job in the classroom. And I'd had a couple of good experiences in practice teaching. I taught in junior high school, and then I taught one semester at Jefferson High School in L.A. And so I was reasonably realistic, and my first teaching job was in an eight-year elementary school in Trail Valley. And I taught science classes, which were easy for me. The general science was good, was easy. I was, you know, fresh enough on lots of things so that I could whip up a science course with sort of very, very modest textbook materials and no laboratory situation, no demonstration equipment or anything, but I could still pull together a satisfactory science course. It was easy to do. The reading classes I taught, I found extremely interesting. They were always valuable to me all the rest of my teaching. I learned that on the job, just day to day, and I had a very good principal there who encouraged me to do my own thing. He said, "You're going to have a lot of kids who are terrible readers," and I said, "Well, what's the proper way to do this?" And he'd say, "Well," he said, "I could tell you what they've been doing here." He said, "But frankly, it hasn't worked. I'd rather you did something else. So go do your own thing." And this guy just gave me carte blanche, and he gave me the address of Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena and told me to go on up there and look over the reading materials and see what I could find that looked to me like they would work with these kids and supplement whatever we had. And we really had quite a few books. We had a lot of stuff on reading. The principal was strong on the subject. And I think I did an adequate job, you know, probably because I was different than any reading teacher these kids had ever seen. and that's part of it. Any new program works because of the novelty effect. Even if it isn't really a very good program, I mean, it just gives it an extra boost, and I was some kind of a novelty, and I think that's part of the reason for success.
So, in other words, UNC gave you a good science education?
Yeah, I had an adequate technical education. But the all of that 30 units of adult education I took was a bunch of garbage. The student teaching was valuable. I had a good class in educational test and measurements, which I did use over the years. But the educational philosophy, the various practicums and class instruction that I took, all the education garbage was just a waste of time and money. And, two or three courses would have been all I needed, actually, to function with all that.
Did you want to study geology, or did you study other kinds of science?
Well, I took a degree in geology, but I had been at one stage an engineering major, and so I had the undergraduate science. You know, an engineer, and then rather the lower division classes, and then the upper division stuff I took was practically all of the geology classes. Because I had all of the chemistry and physics, astronomy, and stuff that I needed before I was actually a geology major. But the science department at SC, I thought was the quite as the geology process. You know, it wasn't Caltech, it wasn't quite as rigorous as UCLA, but it was good.
Yeah.
But
anyway,
they gave
you things that were useful the rest of your life, unlike
here
at the
kitchen
department.
Yes, except that I never worked as a geologist.
Yeah, but there were things that you could use.
Oh, yes. Oh, I used it in the kitchen, yes. Yeah. And I also, later on, I taught social studies. Times when I would teach geography units, and I had some better than usual geography teacher's background in a lot of subject areas that are taught in geography. Oh, yeah, geology teacher. But the education courses were a bunch of crap and a waste of time, insult to intelligence. As a matter of fact, they turned people off. I saw good people who decided they didn't want to be teachers after having been exposed to the school of education at UAC. I mean, this is what education is all about. I wanted a job I could have some self-respect in, and they said, the hell of teaching. And you didn't even try to teach. Just turned off by the education. Well, they were the joke of the school. I mean, I was ashamed almost of the fact that I got a degree. I got a master's degree in education. You didn't mention that among intellectuals. That's almost like having had the posh, you know. You don't just don't talk about it.
Yeah,
they're trying to
get on the
conversation. Yeah. Well, things were bad all over. I mean, at that time, the University of California was the hotshot public school in California, and their school of education was considered to be a big garbage bin, too, the same way as you have UCLA. And I understand that Stanford and the other private schools, too. I mean, schools of education were, you know, not to be considered a serious part of the university.
Now you're
going to
talk about the
Lake
Coastal Plan.
Well, I was on the Citizens Local Coastal Planning Committee in Long Beach for a few years or so. The plan was the most comprehensive of any local program, at least in the whole state, and it was adopted early. Many of the larger constituency programs have not been adopted. County of Los Angeles, City of Los Angeles, City of San Diego, for instance, are not adopted yet. But our program is kind of a model for all of the states. And we have a lot of very conscientious people working on our committee, some of whom are rather disappointed at this stage of the game, because they sort of considered that the adopted plan would have the The force of law, or the permanence, that it hasn't demonstrated, because many of the major parts had to be implemented by changes in the zoning ordinance. When the zoning ordinance was in line with the local coastal plan. And what they're finding now is that the zoning ordinances can be changed, and that they are at a not rapid rate, so that there is a rather consequential erosion in a very short time of some of the best goals of the local coastal plan. I'm not shattered by this myself, because I was always very, very realistic. I have seen many master plans for the Long Beach shoreline over the years, and none of them has ever come to full fruition. They're always modified, and in many cases they're just forgotten, or when development is done, the plan is simply ignored. And you have some members of the city council, like Russ Ridley, who just ignored plans. He says, well, this is just a conceptual thing at a certain place in time, and we're not bound by this. You know, we'll do what we think is best on the occasion. And for citizens who work hard to try to formalize a development plan with the idea that their labors are going to have some effect for some time in the future, they won't have to fight every issue all the way through because they set up the general frame. This is a big disappointment to find out that the plans are very, very flexible and quite ephemeral. But at any rate, the local coastal plan development was a very, very valuable experience for me, because as much as I've been involved in civic activities and political work, I never before had sat on a committee that dealt with lots of fine details, zoning for instance, where very, very divergent groups, realtors, developers, environmentalists, would sit down together and compromise on a final plan that pleased nobody. But yet it was the best everybody could get out of it. And the essence of the whole process was compromise. But no group was able to get what they wanted. But it brought true to me how complicated public processes are. Because there are interests which are not necessarily venal, which are divergent. And the process of government is somehow finding a compromise path that doesn't hurt these divergent interests too much. In other words, how do you steer the best path through these rapids and rocks? And I had always been very intolerant of governmental agencies, legislatures and councils, or the supervisors for compromising and selling out. But when I was sort of in the negotiating position myself, it was much more apparent as to why this was so. This is the way you get things done. Otherwise, everybody picks up their marbles and goes home, and business stops. There has to be compromise.
But who were the interests that were most represented and came most consistently to the FCC meeting?
On the environmental side, the League of Women Voters, the Sierra Club, and a number of homeowner groups, the Alameda State Beach Preservation Group, a group called Committee on Responsible Development, the Alameda Heights homeowners, the Belmont Park, Belmont Heights homeowners, the Beach Area Concerns.